Hey everyone, welcome back to The Forum, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Aubrey.
And it's Cleo here. Thanks for socializing with science today. Before we get started with today's topic of interest, we have some news for you all.
Yeah, we do. Cleo and I are very excited to introduce you all to our shiny new co-host, our new partner in science, if you will. Say hi, Daniela.
Hey guys, my name is Daniela Baeza, and like Aubrey and Cleo, I'm a senior fellow with ISGP, and I'm so excited to be co-hosting the forum. I've been listening since it premiered, and I can't wait to be a regular contributor.
And we're excited to have you, Daniela.
Aw, thanks, Cleo.
So since this is your first episode, Daniela, why don't you tell our listeners where they can go today to contribute to the online conversation surrounding this podcast episode?
Alrighty. If you at home want to join the conversation, be sure to tweet us your questions, comments, and opinions at ISGP Forum with the hashtag ISGP Forum. And you'll find our show on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
See, she's already a pro.
Okay, so now that we've got the introductions out of the way.
Right. Let's get this episode started. Today's podcast will discuss a debate that occurred at one of our climate change-themed conferences, which was held in November of 2015 in Toms River, New Jersey.
The Shore's Future, Living with Storms and Sea Level Rise, was the name of the conference.
And the paper in question, titled New Jersey Shore's Future, Coping with Climate Change and Storm Risk, was written by Tom Knutson from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a.k.a. NOAA.
So, as the ISGP's resident Jersey girl, this entire conference held a very special place in my heart.
Just because you go to Princeton doesn't make you a Jersey girl.
How dare you? I was born and raised in South Jersey, grew up eating pork roll, and learned to drive without ever knowing how to pump gas. I still don't know how.
Okay, fine, you win.
Hey, I know that the beaches are a big part of New Jersey culture. Did you spend a lot of time there, Aubrey?
Of course. My family frequented LBI, or Long Beach Island, and another part of Jersey culture is calling it going down the shore instead of to the beach. Unless you're already down the shore, then you can go to the beach.
Okay, that is so confusing.
Well, whether you go down the shore or to the beach, one thing's certain. The New Jersey shore, as well as much of the northeastern United States, is in danger of suffering drastic changes in the near future due to both human-caused and natural climate change.
Right. So let's have a brief overview of climate change, shall we? Climate change science is based on long-term statistics, modeling, and predictions, making it poised to influence decision-makers at the local, regional, and national levels. It's important to recognize that this is different than, say, weather forecasting, which is very short-term and doesn't really have the potential to impact policy. I want to come back to the climate change modeling point later on, by the way. Don't let me forget that.
Noted. Anyway, climate change is also a really broad umbrella-like term which has implications for more specific weather and climate-based topics. For instance, Mr. Knutson mentions that sea level and temperature are two parameters undergoing changes at present, and they're likely to continue changing into the future. Those are increases in sea level and temperature, by the way.
And sea level rise is something that really hits home for the Jersey Shore and all of the attendees of our Toms River Conference. Mr. Knutson admits that sea level rise is already impacting the Jersey coast for sure, but by the end of this century, the level of the ocean in this area could rise considerably more.
Yeah, we're talking about the meter/yardstick scale, which, by the way, is a very big deal, considering scientists start getting nervous about infrastructure damage when predicting only inches of rise. All in all, it's a pretty logical math problem. Rising seas plus rising temperatures equals greater risk of coastal damage, both to the environment and to properties.
Especially when it comes to storms. Here's another math problem. Any old storm plus higher sea level equals greater storm impacts, I would think. Do we have more Hurricane Sandys to prep for in the future?
Well, for starters, climate modeling seems to suggest that recent hurricanes near the Jersey coast have resulted from warming of the northern and tropical Atlantic Ocean regions. Future uniformity or non-uniformity of this warming will impact the strength of the hurricane.
In terms of trends, I'd be lying if I said that future storm trends were well understood, Daniela. Since the 1800s, there has been no distinguishable trend in hurricanes reaching land in the United States. Nonetheless, we can look at climate models and make some very general predictions. At present, these predictions say something like, the number of hurricanes we get may decrease, but the intensity of the hurricanes will likely increase.
And by more intense, you mean things like rainfall quantities and wind speeds?
Exactly.
Hey, this might be a good time to come back to climate modeling, Aubrey. What did you want to say about it anyway?
Good point. I really just wanted to describe how the modeling can actually be performed, since I know a decent chunk of the debate time was spent on this very discussion.
That's a good idea. Mr. Knutson and the debaters chatted about two different ways climate modeling is typically performed. One involves historical experiments.
Which to me sounds like we're going back to the future or something.
Don't be silly, Cleo. In a historical experiment, scientists can subject a model, which starts with, say, temperature in the 1850s, to a variety of historical events that might impact that temperature. We're talking about things like volcanic activity and aerosol usage here. Then we can see how the global temperature would be predicted by the model to change over time due to these events. Simply put, if the model spits out today's actual, real-life global temperature, we can have more confidence in the validity of the model to predict future outcomes.
I guess that makes more sense than rounding up a flux capacitor. So what's the second climate model experiment that you mentioned, Aubrey?
Well, this other model is a future scenarios test, which, unlike the historical experiment, does less to improve our confidence in a model and more to offer predictions on which we can base policy. Once you have a climate model you feel good about, you can compare predicted climate outcomes based on hypothetical actions that could be taken in the future. In other words, we can predict what will happen if we keep on keeping on, aka maintain the status quo for things like emissions, etc., as well as what will happen if we adopt slight mitigation measures, or if we adopt strong mitigation measures.
So essentially, researchers are plugging in different scenarios to these models, both things we are currently doing and what we could be doing, and seeing what happens. The debaters mentioned that it was this type of climate modeling that was used to draft the 1990 Clean Air Act, as well as legislation that resulted in the phasing out of chlorofluorocarbon products.
Okay, so I think we definitely have a better understanding now of how these predictions are made. But the conference participants all recognize that some of these predictions are shaky at best. For instance, we don't know what climate change means for the number of hurricanes at the Jersey Shore, and I'm pretty sure that's important to know.
Sure, but it still boils down to this. Even if storm frequency and intensity remain the same as they are today, future sea level rise will result in increased storm surge risk. So we need to pay attention, and we need to pay attention now.
Wait, can we define storm surge, though? To be honest, it's making me think of the power outages that happen during storms, which really only makes me late to work because my alarm doesn't go off. But I'm pretty sure that's not what we're going for.
Don't worry, Cleo. We can all relate to that. But anyway, yeah, let's define storm surge. Let's see. NOAA defines storm surge as a rise in water level above the normal tidal level as a result of a storm. Think of it this way. You've probably seen video footage on the news of ocean waves crashing into seawalls during hurricanes. But these same walls don't even get wet during normal high tides, hence storm surge.
Oof, so our coastlines are in danger of rising water levels regardless of other significant factors like hurricanes and atmospheric temperature.
To put it simply, yes. Snooki and company, beware.
Oh, please do not. Never again. Ever.
Sorry, you had to know it was coming at some point during this episode.
But in all seriousness, Cleo's right. The coastlines are going to have to adapt or prepare for future impacts of climate change. The question is, what form should this adaptation take? And how drastic should the preparations be? My gosh, we need to know the current risks before we can even begin making estimates of future risk. And
breathe, Daniela. Let's start by analyzing the current state of climate science before we get into how to address the science.
Sorry, guys. Just getting ahead of myself over here.
Okay, so let's get one thing out of the way first. Human-related climate change is directly correlated with greenhouse gas emissions.
And greenhouse gases are molecules that, when in the atmosphere, trap infrared radiation from the sun closer to the Earth's surface. An example of a greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide. And as an electrochemist whose research involves transformation of CO2 into more useful molecules, I have a special love-hate relationship with the little monster.
Anyway, certain aspects of our climate have more predictable correlations with increased greenhouse gas levels than others. We can say with confidence, for instance, that temperature increases with heightened greenhouse gas levels, whereas hurricanes, as we mentioned before, we're not so sure about.
Regardless, the magnitude of even the more predictable changes, like temperature, is less predictable, and this is on a global scale.
A factor that is significant when considering most policymakers in niche areas, such as the Jersey Shore, for instance, want to know about climate change impacts not on the world as a whole, but on their smaller region. And this makes sense, right? They need to make decisions for the area in their jurisdiction.
But because global predictions already have wide error bars of uncertainty, it's clear that these smaller scale, Jersey Shore-sized predictions will have even more uncertainty associated with them.
And Mr. Knudsen thinks that these local scale impacts should be a major focus of climate research in the near future. He says we need to understand the science as well as its projected impacts.
He also wants the scientists to make an effort to communicate their findings to the public, which includes the policymakers. But we'll get back to the communication issue in a bit. That's another can of worms.
So, was that fishing reference on purpose, since we're talking about oceans today?
Not at all, Daniela. I'm just saying that communication is another fish we'll have to fry later.
Someone's on a roll today. But anyway, there's a very local problem in New Jersey, which can definitely be extrapolated out to other coastal communities. But each location will have to analyze their own risks and make or not make their own adaptation decisions.
Exactly. For instance, residents can commit to making themselves more aware of the risks associated with living in shore areas. If I were my high school softball coach who had a summer home directly on the bay in LBI, for example, I would want to think about what storm surge could do to my property.
And what to do about it in advance. Maybe you could mitigate your risk of damage by purchasing flood insurance, as an example.
How about what to do in the event of an actual severe storm or flood? Having an emergency evacuation plan probably wouldn't be the worst idea.
And emergency prep and planning definitely involves local governments, too.
Sure. These governments need to be up to date on the changing storm-related risks that their communities are facing. The risks need to be relayed to the residents in direct messages that allow people to understand all of their mitigation options.
This would ensure that the residents can do their job in being prepared, and then the government could do its part in providing communal relief.
What does communal relief look like exactly?
Well, Mr. Knudsen offered some examples. Emergency shelters might be either constructed or designated. Land zoning might be altered as necessary. Flood insurance programs could be modified. And these are just a few possibilities. Particular actions would be community specific, of course.
All this to save your precious Jersey Shore, Aubrey.
All this to save the miles and miles of coastline throughout the world, Cleo.
All this to mitigate the damage to the coastline, guys.
Fair enough.
Okay, but you guys, we would be at fault if we didn't mention that climate adaptation is already happening in a handful of public and private sectors. For instance, at the public level, U.S. agencies like the Coast Guard have been planning for the administration of new shipping routes through the Arctic, which have been made possible due to rising temperatures.
And at the private level, the oil industry has been in consultation with climatologists regarding how to best prepare for the construction of offshore oil platforms that can survive heightened storm intensities.
So, whether you agree with these specific adaptation measures or not, they should be looked at as examples of proactivity in the face of a scary forthcoming reality associated with climate change.
Sure, but there's always room for improvement, right? The debaters liked that FEMA, or the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is now asking planners to consider climate change impacts. They thought that this could be taken one step further, and similar actions could be taken specifically by the National Flood Insurance Program.
It was noted that the National Flood Insurance Program has these flood hazard maps that they use to assess flood risk for a given region. The debaters thought it was necessary for the program to consider projected sea level rise in these maps, which would require depoliticizing the issue of climate change in government.
Alrighty, well, this seems like a great place to transition to another significant challenge society faces when it comes to climate change, since politicized issues like climate are so often impacted by communication. And that's what we'll tackle now, the challenges surrounding climate science communication.
Okay, Mr. Knutson says that half of the problem is that while scientists tend to agree on the general trajectories of future climate, they may not agree on the specifics. So, for instance, they might not agree on the number of feet of sea level rise in a given period of time.
But they do agree that general changes are happening. So, in the case of Cleo's example, while they might not agree on the number of feet of sea level rise, they do agree that sea level rise is happening. Now, from the public's perspective, the fact that the specifics are often debated leads many to conclude that scientists don't understand climate change or are not in agreement regarding its existence.
Which is definitely not the case. But it's tough because climate science is inherently uncertain because of the climate modeling process. In other words, prediction errors propagate over time, even if they begin as small errors.
Sure, but at the same time, the public needs actionable information.
Well, Mr. Knutson suggested that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC reports, be used as guides that enumerate consensus statements reached by climate scientists. That's a starting point for actionable info, I would think.
And we can't forget about the inherent complication of distributing science to non-scientists. Namely, scientists need to talk about statistical certainties, percentages, and probabilities, while the public would much rather hear yes or no when asking whether a certain event, say Hurricane Sandy, is going to happen.
So true. As Mr. Knutson explained, storm-induced flooding at a particular location might have a 1 in 250 chance of occurring at the present time. But in the future, because of uncertainties and without any reductions in emissions, that same flooding could be 1 in 50 to 1 in 200.
That alone is more numbers than my brain ever wants to deal with. And that's not even considering a variety of scenarios when emissions levels are reduced.
Right, so it's pretty clear that climate science is messy, but it directly impacts the public, so they need to be aware of it. This is where Mr. Knutson thinks that scientists need to do a better job of communicating with the public.
And in this case, the public is referring to residents, policymakers, and even other scientists. And communications can refer to information dissemination using websites, papers, and widespread reports like the IPCC, which we mentioned earlier, or the National Climate Assessment.
Though, we should note that the debaters felt the IPCC report, as a key example, remains too jargony and technical for most people to actually get anything out of reading it. It's important that the writers of these types of documents include credible information portrayed understandably.
That's super important to consider, since Mr. Knutson actually called for all citizens, in general, to read the National Climate Assessment, one of these technical documents, didn't he?
He did. So climate change communication and education is a two-way street. Scientists need to perform outreach, but the citizens themselves need to do their due diligence as well.
Perhaps part of that due diligence could be learning about science in school, which could occur if science literacy programs in K-12 schools were strengthened. The debater suggested this anyway.
Well, I see where they were going with that. Because if everyone understands even just the basics of the scientific challenge at hand and sees the potential negative impacts on them personally, then they'll be more likely to take action.
Heck, it was mentioned that insurance rates provide a pretty good estimate of financial risk. So if a citizen becomes personally responsible for financing the repair of their beachfront home, you know, rather than relying on the government to help them out, I'd say that citizen would be motivated to take action against climate impacts.
But citizens aren't the only ones being called upon to take action, though. Mr. Knutson calls out the policymakers, asking them to use the climate science tools and assessments prepared for them to develop policies that consider those uncertainties we talked about earlier.
These policies, on a state and federal level, must consider impacts at the global scale and must have foresight for future generations living with this climate challenge.
That's a little vague, though. Can you give an example?
Sure. How about public transportation?
better public transportation systems could be implemented, which would reduce emissions globally. And if the infrastructure is sound and forward-thinking, it will mitigate climate problems for current and future earthly inhabitants.
Oh gosh, I can imagine it now. Hordes of public buses transporting eager beachgoers from various inland New Jersey locations to one of the several coastal hotspots. Come to the Jersey Shore this summer for family fun, where residents pump their fists instead of gas.
You're basically a walking advertisement.
I can't believe you just made another Jersey Shore reference. That show gave us the worst reputation that we totally do not deserve.
Well, we all might as well enjoy the Jersey Shore now, before Trenton becomes the new beachfront property.
Sea level rise. I see what you did there.
Well, on that note, I think we ought to wrap things up for today. I've had about enough of my co-host sass regarding my home state, so maybe I'll go down the shore for the afternoon. You both better be jealous.
Not gonna lie, I kind of am. Anyway, while Aubrey's at the beach, Daniela and I will be scouring our social media to see what you thought of today's episode. Is it time to start taking sea level rise more seriously? Do coastal governments need to start mandating mitigation efforts?
Should flood insurance programs be unsubsidized, making individuals who want to enjoy life at the shore fiscally responsible for that risky decision?
Tweet us your thoughts using the hashtag ISGPForum, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at ISGPForum.
Don't forget to like us on Facebook as well.
Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today. Hope you enjoyed socializing with science, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.